Yeah, hello. Thank you for coming tonight, especially since I think with the Independence opening and the Armory and so many receptions and talks and other programs, we feel very honored that you came for our conversation and performance pieces. My name is Klaus Biesenbach. I am director of MoMA PS1 and chief curator at large here at MoMA. I'm the curator of Andy Warhol Motion Pictures, which is actually on view on the sixth floor, and I just learned, I'm so out of the loop, from our education's director, Pablo Helguera, that the museum will be open late. So if you like, you can afterwards go upstairs and have a look at the exhibition. Also, Conrad Ventura, one of the artists performing tonight, made such a wonderful display weeks ago for an event that he and I conceived together with a group called Pop Rally. And is basically taking screen tests of the audience and projecting them large in the atrium, seemingly so successful that this is now an idea in the world and it's reperformed tonight. So I'm thanking Conrad for this and giving him credits. So first I would like to introduce both of the artists, and then we have conversations, question and answers, and then John will perform for 15 minutes, and then we will watch Conrad's work on the big screen. First, introducing John Jono. I think John doesn't need any introduction, but it's always good to do something official, because then you have to do your homework and find out, oh, when are you exactly born and where did you study? So John and I met 20 years ago in Berlin. You did a poetry reading with, I think, Emmett Williams and Dorothy Iannone. So truly international artist, truly of international reputation. John was born in 1936 in New York, one of the few New Yorkers I think I know, but actually both of you are New Yorkers. You graduated Columbia in 1958, and we're here on the occasion of the Warhol show, Warhol on screen, off screen. 2 years later, you met Warhol. And my office gave me this biography where you were called a sexual, spiritual, and artistic radical. I said, wow, am I allowed to mention this and quote this? And it sounds interesting. So as you know, volumes of John's poetry were published also recently, an anthology, 50 years of work. And MoMA is especially connected to John, because in 1970, Dial a Poem in the Important Information Show, after it has been on, had been on view, on view, on audio in other institutions, MoMA was fortunate enough to have Dial a Poem here, which made poetry really accessible for millions of people. And like a month ago, I visited John's studio preparing for tonight, and you showed me some of the press, and that was partially the reason I thought I could call you a radical, because the press from Time Magazine, New York Times, everything, they were basically, and we will talk about this, but this was such an important kind of added change in time when you had all the liberation movements, where the artistics, society, everything changed. I think your piece was really a catalyst. Talking about Conrad, Conrad Ventu and I worked on Greater New York this year. I know Conrad through the music scene quite a long time ago. I would also say nearly 12 years ago. And then Conrad did Useless magazine. Conrad is, I would call you a, would I call you a conceptual artist or a multimedia artist? Or I don't know. But I call him an artist. He's born in 1977, as I said, in Brooklyn. And so both, I would actually both of, call both of you artists. And then John, with this incredible gift of performance and poetry and being a catalyst and a provocateur and keeping all of us inspired. And I think you were integrally connected with many artist friends like Brian Geisen, just saw the show, it's a new museum, or William Burroughs, or Andy Warhol. And I think in this aspect, the two of you are actually in a beautiful way similar. So perhaps we three of us sit down and start discussing, and then we have question and answers before, because we didn't want to interrupt the performance, and the performance can go as long as John wants, and Konrad screenings can be uninterrupted by questions. Thank you.
Yeah, the first round, I thought it would be incredibly, let's call it informational, to hear a couple of details from you directly. As I mentioned, you met Warhol in
62. At his show, among other times. In December.
Can you hear John?
December of 62.
And I wrote an essay years ago when I didn't know you so well on sleep. And so first it didn't occur to me, so I thought, oh, there is this artist who just puts a camera onto the Empire State Building and perhaps he just leaves or whatever. And then sleep, I kind of didn't really understand that this is such, of course, a completely different procedure, because you're not the Empire State Building, you are a living human being who is sleeping or not sleeping. Were you sleeping throughout sleep?
Yes, I love to sleep, so it was very easy.
We see you up here, and I just walked a group of kids through the show, and they don't even see you breathe. And then I said, wait a minute. So I made them wait and see if it really moves, and they were like really happy to see that. So we go way back, we can talk this way. So how long did it take to make sleep?
Well, Andy got the idea in that spring of 63 to do a movie, and sleep came to him because I slept a lot, and he saw me sleeping. So.
And how did he see you sleeping?
Well, when I used to drink really a lot, so when you drink a lot, you sleep. And then there was, so he had this idea, and it was actually Memorial Day weekend of 1962. We were up in Olime, Connecticut, and we were sleeping together. And I drank a lot, so it was very easy to sleep. And Andy, as we know, his drug of choice was speed. So he was up all night looking at me. And occasionally I would wake up, and I'd see him looking at me with these Betty Davis eyes, and I'd say, what are you doing? And he'd say, watching you. And then the third or fourth time, I said, what are you doing? And he said, wouldn't you like to know? And so that night, he got the idea for sleep.
So was there a lack of rooms and beds? Or why were you in, were you lovers at the time?
Well, we were really good friends, yes.
And and so, because then when I wrote the essay, it occurred to me, actually, that is what happens. Lovers look at each other when, like, one is awake and the other is sleeping. It's quite the most amazing. It's totally not boring. People always think it's so boring to look at the Empire State Building or to look at somebody sleeping. But it's actually the nicest thing if you have a special friendship with somebody. It's a nicer thing to look at somebody.
And that's what Andy wanted to do. He wanted to make a movie of the way you watch a person sleeping when your love is. You're lying there just watching it, watching the thing you love endlessly. Except that he didn't know how to make a movie. He had never made a movie, and he didn't know how to make a movie. He would have liked to do Empire to begin with, if he could get an intimate shot, but that was sort of off the radar, and that's not even the word. And so it was that concept of watching somebody sleep.
And that wasn't, it's not a digital kind of like hard drive that you can just switch on, and then you sleep for how many ever hours. How did it physically work?
So there were three shoots. He got around to, the first shoot was July of 63, and he bought a Bolex camera, which was about this very small one. And so one day we started, it was sort of after 4th of July, whatever it was, and he came with a couple of lights, and he started shooting on the Bolex, and he shot for about 10 days, or 2 weeks, every other night he would come. We'd go to a party and get back to my place at around 1 o'clock, and I'd take off my clothes and we'd start this thing. And the next morning there'd be the yellow boxes all over the floor.
And it's quite interesting.
So what happened, the problem was after he did this whatever, 10 days of actually shooting, it turned out that they had two minute films. And every 20 seconds, you had to rewind. He had to rewind. And then when he got them developed, there were these hundreds of boxes of two-minute films where every 20 seconds, the thing went like that. So it was completely unusable. Then there was a filmmaker called Bud Wurtschafter. who said, Andy, there's a gadget. You plug it in and plug it in the wall, and it reminds automatically. So in August, we should do another, less than 10 days, 8 days, 5 days. And when he got that back, hundreds of rolls, every 2 minutes, when you put them together, you can't. Every 2 minutes, it sort of goes like that. And so that was the second shoot. And then something rather important happened in September. We got the idea for how to duplicate the repetitions. And he shot again for just 2 nights in October because he knew what he wanted, particularly headshots and whatever. And then
most people think that it is because now we are in the age of easy camera handling and digital and whatever. Most people, I think, actually think that you were just sleeping and he was just filming like one night in real time. So it was basically over half a year.
That's what he would have loved. That's what he wanted the people to think. That was the concept.
When you first saw it, what did you think?
When first saw it, that first time when we got the 2 minute things that had the blip every 20 seconds, it was just so, with Andy, they were just black and white, such beautiful things. It wasn't me, it was he was a great photographer, great images. And then I stayed, I knew enough, I'm not a film, I know what I can do, I'm a poet and that's it, you know. So I stayed out of any suggestions, and it was really interesting how Andy struggled, because as the months went on, he got, the one thing he knew how to get a lot of publicity. So as the months went on, it was in every newspaper, every magazine, Vogue, from Vogue to Harper's Bazaar to Ladies Home Companion. and he did not know how to put this film together. And at one point in September, he said, it couldn't be any more successful. Why do I have to do it?
I think we're pretty happy he did it. Yeah.
But that was, and then the most curious thing about what happened was, I think, which I really just found out about two years ago, was that in September of '63, John Cage put together a concert of Eric Satie's Vexations at a small theater on Third Avenue. And Andy went and I went. It's a 34-hour piece of 12 with 12 pianists playing Vexations. And Andy was very taken by that. And we went together, and then I went home, and then he went back later that night. But I remember it's a funny story. And I remember there was a program describing Satie, and on the back of the program it said that Satie's brief biography, that he was a Rosicrucianist. And some of the things were formulas, you know, and they had three formulas, like A, B, C, B, C, B, C, D, whatever it is. And so skip to two or three years ago in London, where the Tate Modern is putting on this great show of Sleep in Turbine Hall and 34 hours of Satie playing. And Brandon Joseph, a great American art scholar, was there. And says to me, John, you know, I've seen this film over and over and over again. And you know the repetitions, the way sleep is repeated? It's a Rosicrucian formula. If you analyze it, it goes A, B, whatever it is, A, B, C, B, C, B, C. So the curious thing is that out of desperation, did Andy stumble upon something similar to a Rosicrucian formula? Or out of desperation, did he actually use that formula that he saw in the program as a way of structuring repetition?
Was it Andy's idea to do sleep in the first place?
To do
like with Andy Warhol, many there are always like these kind of like oral history, and then quotes and anecdotes where people say, "Oh, he picked up ideas like you just said with the Satie," but the original idea to do something like sleep, to film you while you were asleep, as an endurance or as a durational piece. Was this something that he was kind of generating himself, or was he inspired by something, or would you know what the original point of departure for him was?
I think he just wanted to make a film. Mm-hmm. And why he wanted to make a film, in that year, 1963, Jonas Mekas started something called the Filmmakers Co-op and Filmmakers Cinematheque, started before in 62, but it was going full speed in 63. And what Jonas did was rent movie theaters that were down for the night. It was like 1930s movie theaters that were still around. They would play Thursday through Sunday. And sometimes three times a week, he would have these showings of different films, four films at a time. And Andy and I and everyone else went to all of them three or four times a week. And so that's where Andy got the idea of seeing the films. And secondly, when the way Jonas programmed them, he would have four films and always one new one, you know, every week. But you had to see the three others. So, I mean, Andy and I and everyone else, you'd see Flaming Creatures for the 12th time, Taylor Meads, Queen of Sheba for the 15th time, and Moran Rice to get to whatever the one, to get to Bruce Conner or Kenneth Anger or whatever. So what's curious is that Andy, seeing all of these movies, saw why they were bad. Saw where each filmmaker made a mistake. You know, you see it over and over, it's just clear. Andy was really smart. That's what generated his feeling to make movies, I think.
So where did you see Sleep the first time?
The finish?
The very first.
Was that at the premiere?
And for me, it's kind of, we programmed upstairs, we built a little movie theater, and of course it's not a movie theater like a 1930s leftover. We kind of made it a digital theater, and you have like a floor-to-ceiling image, so it's a very different, it looks like more like a Douglas Gordon piece, actually, than it looks like a 1930s movie theater. But how do we have to kind of imagine this? How big was the image? Did people really sit there, or did they leave after 10 minutes, or... Oh, where everybody, nobody was, of course, on the cell phones because there were none, but...
Henry Gale, I think, stayed longer than most. He stayed for a couple of hours. And the one soundtrack at the time was that somebody had made a copy of the Satie performance, so Andy had that Sony tape recorder that was played the first night. And it made people angry, or it made people impressed just to sit there. You all know this. Sort of.
How long did you stay?
Well, I stayed briefly because I didn't sort of hated it when it went away.
Do you remember the Empire premiere?
Yes.
And how long did people stay there?
It depends on the people, because in those days there were, it depends on what drug you were on. If you took speed, there were certain drugs or other drugs anyway. They were all endurance movies. I think the movies that Andy became popular was Chelsea Girls. That's when people, because there's two screens and your attention can be held every second for just countless things. That was the moment where it became really popular. Yes?
No, I kind of like your, when you say speed and drunk, and it seems a different world at the time. So when you think about a show like Upstairs, that's now basically, it's totally easy. You don't have to rewind anything, and you see the 60mm in the front, you see the screen test. What was your comment, or what were you thinking when you first saw the show?
Well, it's sort of miraculous that it happened, that you presented it in this way, and it's all in scale. Those screens are a little bit like 16mm movie house. I mean, that's the scale. So it's many theaters in one, and the fact that it's put together so beautifully, and all of it's just like a miracle. Because there's one thing back in sort of that December, Christmas Eve of 1960, we were watching that Yule log burning on television. They used to have on Channel 11. And I said, Andy, wouldn't it be great if they had Sleep? And he didn't even bother answering me. It was such a dumb idea, that so incomprehensible, that it was not worthy of a response. And skip to the last 20 years. In Paris, they showed it in France one night, all night, about 25 years ago. And somebody made a bootleg copy of it. And they show it once a year on the full moon, one of the full moons in France every year for the last 25 years. And it's a bootleg. When I tell this to the Andy Warhol Foundation or the museum, they get furious. How did they get this copy? But anyway, that's sort of like the show here. It's a dream come true to have all that happen. Yes?
Wow, I'm going deeper. That's when you think about your special, your friendship with Andy Warhol, like two artists. And then I mentioned William Burroughs, I mentioned Brian Gysin. Sometimes I get the impression today it's really artists working on their own kind of like plot and not being so influenced. Was that, could you describe that situation a bit, like a performer, poet, artist, and was that common practice that you were sharing ideas like this, or was this just a sign of the times, or?
I sort of was very lucky in that I was born in New York and met a bunch of artists like in 1959, 60, and 61. And by 62, they were having their first shows And it's funny, so I live in the same place now as I lived then, 222 Bowery. And somebody gave me, Wynne Chamberlain gave me a birthday party in 1963, December 4th, 1963. And there were about 80 artists there. And they were Andy and the Pop Artists and Frank Stella and John Cage and Merce Cunningham and George Siegel, just everyone. And the musicians, Phil Glass, et cetera. And they didn't come for me. They came just to be together. They couldn't care less that it was my birthday. But it was still so early, they came as a group just to be together on this Saturday night. And so these people, just seeing them on a daily basis was the enormous influence for me, because you just saw what they did. They had an idea came in their head, and they did it. And if it was good, they followed it. If it wasn't good, they let go. But each one, painting, and it occurred to me that painting and sculpture and music and dance were 50 years behind poetry. I mean, poetry was 50 years behind all this. And there was no reason why I could do, or poets could do the same as all these artists were doing. And to say the poet side, I knew lots of poets, but like Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery were really only interested in you if you wrote like them. And I didn't write like them. So we're gay men, but they were friends of mine, gay men who were friends of mine, but since I didn't write like, they couldn't care less. Allen Ginsberg, if you were a gay man and wrote like him, he liked you, but I didn't write like Allen Ginsberg. So the poets were absolutely no help.
When you did Dial a Poem then, finally at MoMA, arriving here, what was your experience with the piece? Do you want to quickly give your own impressions? Kynaston McShine, it's this incredibly, I'm sure most of you know, incredibly influential show the information exhibition that kind of like showed conceptual pieces, but also certain displays and also new techniques in a way. So he knew about the piece, you were invited to participate. Mm-hmm. The piece caused quite a controversial reaction. Mm-hmm. Why? It's just poetry, you just call it.
But Dial a Poem was on twice in 1968 at the Architectural League of New York, which was the American Federation of the Arts Building, and then at Kenniston Show in 1970. And each time, I mean, there were like, started out with 25 poets and ended up with 200 poets, and it was everyone, John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara and Paul Blackburn and all of them. And in 1968, it seems funny, but the thing that was interesting, there was this thing called sexual liberation or feelings of sexual freedom, which were just beginning. It seems like the battle was just still being fought. And strangely, it hadn't happened yet. So that was interested me in 68 and 69, putting poems and poetry and work dealing with that, on, along with these 200 other poets who had all kinds of poetry. And in 1970, it was more political. The Vietnam War was really really difficult, and the politics were really, so I focused on some more political poems, along with the Frank O'Hara and all the rest of it. And then it sort of got out of hand. I just put pieces. I mean, of the only two out of the 200 was Kathleen Cleaver, who was very articulate, and Bernadette Dorn, who I knew slightly of the Weather People, and Bobby Seale, and amongst the 200 poets. And Diane de Prima, a great poet, had these things called revolutionary letters, 45 revolutionary, little almost like haikus. And I would put one on a day, because that, but along with, we had 12 lines at the museum here, so it was 12. One of them would be Pollard, one of the 12. And one day, there was one of her poems, she wrote it a long time, called How to Make a Molotov Cocktail. Just those simple ingredients, and it was like a haiku, it was a very sweet poem, and we were very young, and so I had it on there. That was the very day that the Weather People blew up the IBM building, a gigantic, horrible catastrophe. Somebody picked up on it, and the headline in the New York Times, call David Rockefeller's museum and find out how to build a bomb to blow up the IBM building. This was in the New York Times, so you can imagine what that did, And it worked out okay, because it was a sensitive issue, and I didn't put that poem on again. So it took a tone.
Sounds like you had an exciting time.
Yes.
Thank you, John. Conrad, so what do you say when you hear that?
Wow.
think we met through Larry T. He's a great musician and party promoter in the Electric Flash era. It was around 2000, 2001, I would say. Mm-hmm. So you also are a man of many talents. So you have many scenes, writing, magazines, conceptual basis. You have recently had a show at the Andy Warhol. How did this come about? Because when you work with the Andy Warhol Museum, it's such a big copyright. You might have, if you saw the show upstairs, you're not allowed to go in with a cell phone or a camera. And it's actually basically when, if you go in and have a camera, they ask you to rewind. It's like a delete, basically, right? There's no rewinding. It's quite strict. How did this collaboration with the Warhol happen?
Well, I'd been going to Miami a few times a year. This is going to be challenging. Well, when you're in the art world, you go to these art fairs. I'd been going down to Miami a few years to promote my own publication, Useless. I'd have a booth at the NADA Art Fair, and I'd just kind of sit there for the duration and kind of hand out this newspaper that I've been publishing for, well, now about 6 years. I met a curator down there, just Eric Shiner, a couple years ago, and we just kept in touch. And at a certain point, he became the Milton Fine Curator of Art at the Warhol, and he had the opportunity to start some solo projects and curate larger group shows at the museum in Pittsburgh. And he rang me up and he said, do you have any ideas? And I have some installations I proposed, and he said, well, why don't you give it a try and put them in the museum? So he gave me a floor. I was a little upset at first. He said I'd have to share the space with Basquiat.
Oh, wow. I think I would be upset.
And Keith Haring. It was a big elephant, actually, and that was very upset about this elephant that I had to share this 4,000 square foot floor with. But once I got there, I realized the elephant wasn't very big. But the series I've been working on for the last couple of years, I did the first one so that I could begin showing this work in that context. So I discussed it with Eric, and he said, well, do you have any other ideas? And I said, well, I've had this idea to redo the screen test. So that's when I went to Poughkeepsie, and I did my first film of Billy Linick, for some of you.
When you go upstairs, people ask what were the criteria, who to pick in the show. And then you can say, oh, it's Allen Ginsberg, and it's Susan Sontag, and it's Dennis Hopper, and it's Lou Reed. So, of course, it was a little bit what you describe as this creative scene of the time of the 60s. But then, of course, it's also when you get kind of reports of the people, how they were actually done. And was fortunate enough that Susan Sontag was there to walk me through her experiences, and she had 7 screen tests done, so she had numerous experience, and she was saying that basically the first one, he just said, sit still, and then she sat still, and this is the one upstairs. She's really like frozen, right? It's like, looks like a photograph. But then you also understand that this is like a screen test. It's like a movie director or so tests if the camera loves you. So you want to love the camera in order to, you want to seduce the camera in order to succeed, to be successful and be an actor again or be used in a movie or whatever. So I think when you stand right in the middle of the screen test, they're all, camera is gone and you are there where the camera was, and those faces, those beautiful faces try to seduce you. But that, of course, is also a little bit of Dorian Gray. How did people react when you said, hey, you did a screen test like 40 years ago when you were like in your early 20s, and I want to, what did people react? What did people say?
There's just a huge variety of response. Some people just don't get back to me. You know, I'll call them, and they won't return the call, or I'll email them, or they won't return the email. Some people say, that was then, this is now, I'm a different person, da-da-da. Other people, like Jonas, just, I emailed him, and 45 seconds later, he said, come on over. I'm kind of losing my train of thought because the responses are really far and wide. Bibi Hansen, who's in the audience, said, actually explained a lot of this gaze, desire sort of thing had to do with the vetting process that these subjects were going through. I think if you succeeded in your screen test, you're kind of like in the in crowd. You kind of win your way, you kind of win your moment in the factory. And if you kind of screw it up, Andy's not going to be calling you again. And you might get the cold shoulder at the door when you try to get back in, kind of thing. So these are the kinds of responses I've gotten just through conversations or just trying to get in touch with people.
A couple of years ago, Jared Malenga, who doesn't live in Poughkeepsie, but he lives in Hudson, oddly enough, just one town up on the Hudson River, he did screen tests with a 16mm camera, and he did one of myself. He asked me, he knew I did the show, and Adam Kimmel was kind of collaborating with him on this Warhol-inspired project, and I sat there and I totally melted down and I couldn't keep my eyes open and I was like crying because it was so bright. And what is the setup for you to do the screen test?
Well, I mean, the primary difference, with the ones done in the 60s, for the most part, you'd have a massive factory space and everybody would come to one particular place, and just whip, throw up the light, someone sit down on the chair, he'd load the film, then you'd go. I mean, most of my films I've had to do in living rooms, kind of throw things together, try to block out window light, and kind of get as much control as I can, because the starting point for me is trying to be a bit art historical, try to get the same frame, try to get the same lighting. And then from the ones I've seen and some of the stills I've seen, try to give direction that would emulate the original.
What is the technique you're using? What is the equipment you're using?
I'm using HD video because I can afford it. The clip lamp, just like, was used before. I mean, you go to the hardware store, you get one for $8. So my kit's very minimal, little lighting stand, clip light, my video camera on a little tripod.
For you as an artist, it's your work, so it's okay, whatever you pick, you pick. But for you as an artist living, experimenting now, is it a huge difference to have a 16mm camera that has a sound, that is mechanical, that is like a kind of a creature in front of you moving and kind of moving and shaking, or just having a video? Is that a translation, or is that your claim to make it yours, or were you ever interested in using that old machine?
I was interested in it for a minute, and then I thought of just the impracticality of using this old technology. And I thought the disconnect between the time and the authors of these different works and the subject and how the subject's changed, I found some of these challenges to be part of the work. So I embraced video, and I didn't think it would be a problem. I thought it would be interesting. I'm in my own time. I'm happy with that. And that's kind of how I thought about the technology. I didn't feel like there's some sort of need for me to do it on 16mm. I've thought of translating it or copying it to 16 and showing it now, because I think that would be another level. And it would speak about the technology. But when I exhibit it now, it's usually just projections, or I put them on, kind of old Sony monitors.
John, when you had the screen test taken with the 16mm, were you aware of the equipment, or was it just as normal as now somebody having like a little digital camera?
It was sort of the earlier screen test. I think Andy said, I said, what should I do? He said, look here. That's why I'm looking over there. And then it was the thing that one knew is that you're not supposed to blink. And when I'm a meditator, so I've spent many years. But in those years, the way you didn't blink is you took some speed. And you could do the 2 minutes or 4 minutes without blinking. And we did a swing test, and I don't think I blinked in my 4 minutes.
Well, you had green tea. We had a tea, and
we had a green tea.
We talked.
That's as far as I got. So that was an important consideration, not blinking.
What was the experience, the two of you collaborating on?
I had a really good time.
I
haven't seen it yet. So
usually that's what I want from this. For me, it's an experience, and I kind of seek to meet somebody and have a conversation and get to know them and hear stories. We just trade stories. And then we have this kind of moment where they sit and for 3 minutes, and then that's it. And I think ours was pretty successful. I got in terms of all of the things. You know,
will we see John's later?
Yeah, it'll be the first one in the reel, and then there'll be four more following it.
Do you want to say a little bit about the other four more?
Yeah. I kind of wrote them down. They're kind of out of... So there's five that we'll see after your performance. Mm-hmm. So the first one's you, then Bibi Hansen, who's here in the audience. Shout out to the hips. Hey. Followed by Ivy Nicholson, I call her the Kate Moss of the 50s. And pretty fabulous. Then Steve Balkin. Who I've included because of, I think it's one of the most perfect recordings I've done, just in terms of getting the lighting absolutely perfect, the expression, the kind of re-performance, if you would. It's very close to the original, and Steve's here too. Hey. And then Mario Montez, who hasn't worked with anybody since actually the year of my birth.
Wow.
And he's now working on an ongoing photo and video project with me that's non-quotational. It's completely different than this. But I went to Florida last year and did this, a couple of videos of him, including this screen test. So. And then that'll be it. Just those five.
I think I saw Randy Burscheid. Is he here? Randy.
I wish I could have played all of my films, but I think you would all leave. Because there's 13, it's kind of like a volume of 13. It's sort of like my 13 most beautiful, if you will. But I think that's over 70, I don't know. They're 4 minutes each, I can't do math. But we do need a soundtrack or something.
52 minutes.
Yeah.
So I thought we should open the Q&A now. Because I would hate it that you kind of like, then we have to interrupt or just let the performance take over, and the screenings take over. Mm. Are there any questions or are you? Oh, I'm sorry.
I was wondering if you thought of doing the modern ones in color. Oh. I was wondering if you were thought of doing the modern ones in color.
Well, they all are color, and then I go through a kind of conversion process. I make them black and white. I slow the speed down. I'm not really sure what that means. I have these as color recordings. Some of them are really beautiful in color, but
when I saw them on the screens, they looked black and white.
They're black and white. I think once I make them black and white and put them out there as black and white, they'll stay black and white. I mean, it's kind of a quotational work, so I'm trying to keep them similar to these kind of originals, and that means they're going to be black and white for the most part. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of so iconic. I just gave a tour recently, and I showed them Sleep, and they said, "Oh, that's like the Sam Taylor Wood when she filmed John Beckham," and so I said, "Wow, that's an interesting." Twist. Turn it around. Is there more questions?
My wife, sometimes mentions that Andy would go to these screenings of Jonas Mekas, and I was wondering if you felt like Jonas was a big influence. Sorry, this is for John Jordan, obviously. Influence on Andy during that early period because she. she talks about being downtown all the time, and very much like what you said, her father was an artist, Al Hansen, and she said everyone went to everyone's thing. They were always at Judson Church or, you know, whatever venue. So I wondered if Jonas was an influence on Andy at that time.
I think he was an enormous influence, one for what we've just been talking about, three times a week going to all these movies. And it was more, Jonas's influence was that he was able to sort of pull this energy together. So I think the reason why Andy or all of us were attracted to it was all this energy. We didn't know why, we just went because it was great. And then Jonas, when Andy shot the early things of Sleep, Jonas saw instantly. And so he planned to put it on the cover of Screen Culture. Sleep came out in January of 1964. And it was on the cover at the beginning of December. But before the movie, before there was any movie, it was on the cover of Film Culture. So it got this enormous effect. And it was at that point that Andy had it in that next month finally put together the 6.5 hours. And without Jonas's encouragement, is the point. Probably things might have been different. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What year did you meet Andy?
I met him in 62.
Did you meet him in New York City?
At the Sydney, the first show of the Pop Artists at Sydney, Janice Gowrie, that opening. I didn't actually meet him, but he was there. I saw he was there. And then 3 days later, he had a show at the Stable Gallery, which was November 3rd or something. And I met him, and we became friends from then on. Hmm.
And have you been in more than one movie of
it? No, just no. Sleep.
Only one?
Yes.
It's very long.
That's interesting.
Has any more questions? So perhaps without further ado, we have the incredible privilege of being here for your performance and for your thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to read some poems. And the first one is called Everyone Gets Lighter. Life is lots of presents, and every single day you get a big bunch of gifts under a sparkling pine tree hung with countless balls of colored lights. The red one with the green ribbon and the green one with the red ribbon and the blue one with silver and the white one with gold. It's not what happens. It's how you handle it. You are in a water bubble human body on a private jet in seemingly a god world, a glass of champagne, a certain luminosity and clarity, skin of air, a flat sea of white clouds below, a vast dome of blue sky above, and your mind is an iron nail in between. It's not what happens, it's how you handle it. Dead cat bounce, catch a falling knife, after endless shadow boxing in your sleep, fighting in your dreams and knocking yourself out. You realize everything is empty and appears as miraculous display. All are in nature, the play of emptiness and clarity. Everyone gets lighter, everyone gets lighter, everyone gets lighter. Everyone is light. And this next poem is called Welcoming the Flowers. I'm standing on the corner of Stanton and Christie, waiting for the traffic light to change. A man is sitting on the steps of a building, holding his young son on his lap. He is eating fried chicken from Chico's Takeout on Houston. He chews on the wings and feeds bits of the breast to his son. The man finishes eating, puts the leftover chicken and bones, fries, and soda can in a paper bag and leaves it on the sidewalk. A brown dog from the neighboring building snoops around, gets its nose in the bag, chews on the bones, and makes a mess. A black cat sitting in a window watches wide-eyed, staring down at the dog, chicken bones, and grizzle. I see their past and present lives. The man eats the chicken, and the chicken was his mother, who had died 2 years ago of cancer. The dog chewing on the bones was his father, who had died 5 years ago of a heart attack. And the cat in the window was his grandmother, and his young son, whom he holds so tenderly, was the man who killed him in his previous life. His wife comes home with the groceries and takes the boy into the building. She had been his lover in many past lives and was his mother for the first time in this one. The world just makes me laugh. Fill what is empty, empty what is full, light as body, light as breath. Welcoming the flowers, daffodils baptized in butter, lilacs luxuriously licking the air, necklaces of wisteria bowing to magnolia mamas, the cherry blossoms are razor blades, the snow dahlias sharp as cat piss. The lilies of the valley are lilies of fur, lilies of feather, lilies of fin, lilies of skin. The almost Miss America rose. They all smell so good, and I get sucked into their meaty, earthy goodness. You make my heart feel warm. I lay my head on your chest and feel free. Filling what is empty, emptying what is full. Filling what is empty, emptying what is full. Filling what is empty, emptying what is full. The gods we know we are, the gods we know we were. I smell you with my eyes and see you with my ears and feel you with my lips and taste you with my nose and hear you with my tongue. I want you to sit in my heart and smile. Words come from sound. Sound comes from wisdom, and wisdom comes from emptiness, deep relaxation in great perfection. Welcoming the flowers, armfuls of honeysuckle and columbine, red-tipped knives of Indian paintbrush, the fields of daisies are the people who betrayed me. The lupine were self-serving and unkind. Orchids are the tongues that lied. Hyacinths are the songs of suicides. The voluminous, voluptuous bougainvillea are flames licking what cannot burn. The big bunch of 1,000 red roses are all the people I made love to. Hit my nose with the stem of a rose. The poppies have pockets packed with narcotic treats. The chrysanthemums are a garland of skulls. I go to death willingly with the same comfort and bliss as when I lay my head on my lover's chest. Welcoming the flowers, the third bouquet is a crown of bluebells, a carillon of foxglove. A sunflower snuggles its head on my lap and gazes up at the sky. May all the tiny black insects crawling on the peony petals be my sons and daughters in future lives. Great balls of light, white, red, blue, concentric dazzle, yellow, green, great exaltation. The world just makes me laugh. May sound and light not rise up and appear as enemies. May I know all sound as my sound. May I know all light as my light. May I spontaneously know all phenomena as myself. May I realize original nature, not fabricated by mind, empty, naked awareness. And this next poem, I started writing in July of 2001 here in New York, and finished by the end of that year, 2001. And it's called There Was a Bad Tree. There was a bad tree, a bad tree the people hated. The leaves gave off a foul smell, and the flowers had a bitter stink. If you got too close, you vomited. The fruit was poison. One bite and you were dead. Everyone really disliked it. The bad tree stunk. They talked incessantly about it and came to a big decision. Cut it down. Get rid of it. They chopped with axes and barely made a dent. Wearing breathing masks, they whacked at it and whacked at it and nibbled and chipped. Oily powder from the shiny, dark green leaves got on their skin, blistered, and was really itchy, and they scratched bloody red. They put on protective gear with oxygen and went at it with electric buzzsaws and heavy equipment, working 24-hour shifts. Finally, they cut it down. Everyone was very happy and celebrated the great victory, a noble deed, well done, and they went to bed exhausted. The next morning, the bad tree had grown back, had sprung up new and bigger and more beautiful and ugly. It was very discouraging. They talked a lot about it and cut it down again and poured gasoline on the roots and burned all the leaves and branches in a big fire. After the smoldering embers got cold, the tree grew back, bigger, more bad, and really gorgeous. Other people had been watching from their houses, waiting their turn. They thought themselves smarter, with higher intellectual capabilities. they knew how to get rid of the tree. It was a growing plant, a wood tree that grew in the earth. They incinerated it, burned the roots with chemicals, vaporizing acids and robotic lasers, detonated on the ground, bombed from the air, hit with smart missiles, and bombarded with radiation. They made a firestorm and covered the ground with concrete and steel. The tree grew back, more fresh, more elegant, even gracious, and really ugly. The wood was harder, darker, thick, hot muscle, and the leaves, full and lush, moved like underwater plants luxuriously in the breeze. It was extremely discouraging, extremely depressing, a catastrophe. They had made for themselves a hell world. They talked incessantly about it and came to a big decision. The mayor resigned in disgrace, and those who had worked so hard left, humiliated, moved to the other side of town, stayed away. Then, out of the blue, appeared these beautiful people. They were simple and humble and a little like peacocks and seemingly well-intentioned with a great sense of humor. Radiantly relaxed, oozing loving kindness and compassion, they walked right up and started eating the leaves. They ate the leaves and enjoyed them, became happy, and laughed, and chomped on more leaves. You could tell they really liked the taste. They pressed their cheeks to the flowers, black velvet coated with transmission oil. They licked the sweet juices that seeped from the petals. The pollen was coal dust and petroleum gas burying their noses. They sucked in deep breaths, eating the smell. Great bliss. They discovered the fruit hidden beneath the leaves. Overripe mangoes with sticky eggplant skin hung like testicles. And inside the meat was fruit was rotting meat like liver. The special people got their faces into the stinking slime and really got into it, inhaling with their lips and teeth and tongues. They licked and drank the thick red juice. The seeds, like cabochon rubies, seemed particularly potent and were chewed with great delight. The fruit contained the five wisdoms. The men and women became luminous. Their skin was golden and their bodies, almost transparent, were clothed in shimmering rainbow lights. They became sleepy, yawned, and curled up under the tree and took a nap. While they slept, music filled the air. Lounging against the gnarled tree trunk and protruding roots, their huge bodies, colored red, yellow, blue, green, white, rested in great equanimity and radiated huge compassion. At the root endings, there were jewels, diamonds and emeralds and rubies. which were stars in the sky of the world below. The beautiful men and women woke up and nibbled on the leaves again. They ate the leaves like deer, pausing between bites, looking up at the vast, empty sky. The leaves and fruit increased their clarity and bliss and introduced the nature of primordially pure wisdom mind. Thank you. I'm going to do one more poem, and this one's called Thanks for Nothing. And I started writing it on my 70th birthday in December of 2006. Thanks for Nothing on my 70th birthday. I want to give my thanks to everyone for everything. And as a token of my appreciation, I want to offer back to you all my good and bad habits as magnificent, priceless jewels, wish-fulfilling gems, satisfying your every need and want. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thanks. May every drug I ever took come back and get you high. May every glass of wine and vodka I ever drank come back and make you feel really good, numbing your nerve ends, allowing the natural clarity of your mind to flow free. May all the suicides be songs of aspiration. Thanks that bad news is always true. May all the chocolate I've ever eaten come back rushing through your bloodstream and make you feel happy. Thanks for allowing me to be a poet, a noble effort doomed but the only choice. I want to thank you for your kindness and praise. Thanks for celebrating me. Thanks for the resounding applause. Thanks for taking everything for yourself and giving nothing back. You were always only self-serving. Thanks for exploiting my big ego and making me a star for your own benefit. Thanks that you never paid me. Thanks for all the sleaze. Thanks for being mean and rude and smiling at my face. I am happy that you robbed me. I am happy that you lied. I am happy that you helped me. Thanks. Grazie. Merci beaucoup. May you smoke a joint with William and spend some intimate time with his mind. More profound than any book he wrote. I give enormous thanks to all my lovers, beautiful men with brilliant minds, great artists, Bob, Jasper, Ugo. May they come here and make love to you. And may my many other lovers of totally great sex, countless lovers of boundless, fabulous sex, countless lovers of boundless, fabulous sex, countless lovers of boundless, fabulous sex in the golden age of promiscuity. May they all come here and make love to you if you want. May they hold you in their arms, bawling to your heart's delight, bawling to your heart's delight, bawling to your heart's delight. May all the people who are dead, Brian Allen Cookie Jack, and I do not miss any of you. I don't miss any of them. No nostalgia. It was wonderful that we loved each other, but I do not want any of them back. Now, if any of you are attracted to any of them, may they come back from the dead and do whatever is your pleasure. May they multiply and be the slaves of whomever wants them, satisfying your every wish and desire. But you won't want them as masters, as their demons. May Andy come here, fall in love with you, and make each of you a superstar. Everyone can have Andy. Everyone can have Andy. Everyone can have Andy. Everyone can have an Andy. Huge hugs to my friends who betrayed me. Every friend became an enemy sooner or later. Deep kisses to my loves that failed. I am delighted you are vacuum cleaners, sucking everything into your dirt bag. You are none other than a reflection of my mind. Thanks for the depression problem and feeling like suicide every day of my life. And now that I'm 74, I'm happily almost there. 20 billion years ago, in the primordial wisdom soup, beyond comprehension and indescribable, something without substance moved slightly and became something imperceptible, moved again and became invisible, moved again and became a particle, and particles moved again and became a quark, and again and became quarks, moved again and became protons and neutrons and the 12 dimensions of space. Tiny fireballs of primordial energy, bits tossed back and forth in a game of catch between particles, transmitting electromagnetic light and going really fast, 40 million times a second, where the pebble hits the water. This is where the trouble began. Something without substance became something with substance. Why did this happen? Because something substanceless had a feeling of missing out on something, not getting it, was not getting it, not getting it, not getting it, not getting something when there was nothing to have. From that primordially endless potential to modern day reality, 20 billion years later, has produced me and my stupid grasping mind, has made me and you and my grasping mind. May Rinpoche and all the great Tibetan teachers who loved me come back and love you more. May they hold you in their wisdom hearts, bathe you in all pervasive compassion, give you pith instructions, and may you, with the diligence of Olympic athletes, do meditation practice, and may you, with great confidence, realize the true nature of mind. America, thanks for the neglect. I did it without you. Let us celebrate poetic justice. you and I never were, never tried to do anything, and never succeeded. Thanks for introducing me to the face of the naked mind. Thanks for nothing.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you. That was incredible. I'm not saying thank you again, because otherwise. So now we're watching Konrad's work. And I think we should dim the light a bit, because it's a little too bright. Thank you. Thank you again.
I just wanted to say a few things before you all kind of stir in your seats. And I'll, I think what I'll do is just, I did a little list of all the films I'd done and kind of the order that I did them over the last 2 years. I started with Billy Name, and I went up to Poughkeepsie and I did the screen test in one of his bedrooms. I'm not showing him tonight, I'm just showing a few for you of this selection. Then I did Bibi Hansen, you just watched. I did that in Gracie Mansion's living room or dining room in the East Village about a year and a half ago. Then I did Ultraviolet in her sort of penthouse apartment on the Upper East Side. Then I went on to Jonas Mekas, Ivy Nicholson in Staten Island, followed by Penelope Palmer also. In the audience, Penelope did her screen test as a baby with Andy Warhol, so I thought, oh, I'll do it with her now that she's a lady. Then I went to Florida. I did Mario Montez in Orlando. Then I moved on to Mary Warrenoff. I actually flew out to L.A. and did Mary, followed by Sally Kirkland, Taylor Mead. Came next, who's probably reading poetry downtown in the Bowery Poetry Club. He does that every Monday. He's been doing it for years. Then John, who you just saw, followed by Randy Borscheid, who I'm not sure if he's still in the audience, but Randy was one of the original 13 Most Beautiful Boys. So was Steve Balkan, who was my 13th film. And, I just thought I'd give a little more meat to the experience tonight. I realize these are a little, 4 minutes seems like a really long time when you're just staring at one face, I think, in silence. So, anyway, there will be three more. Enjoy. Is that good? Okay. Thank you.